All right. Bill, I'm going to start with you, and then we'll bring Barton into the conversation. Why is the World Bank doing this? Why are they supporting autocrats more than with the worst human rights abuses as a place to provide their aid? I mean, historically, U.S. aid specifically has been limited by, you know, human rights violations or the context of how would it help American foreign policy. Why are we giving all these money to these autocrats? What's driving this?
So I'll give you a bureaucratic answer and a foreign policy answer. The sort of the bureaucratic politics is that the World Bank simply wants to give as much aid as possible to keep itself in business. And so it literally wants to give aid to almost every poor country without discriminating. And so there are some egregious cases that it will not give aid, like North Korea, only because it's so egregious that it'd be simply embarrassing. But otherwise, the World Bank just wants to stay in business by giving every government, regardless of how much it is violating the rights of the poor, the aid that the World Bank needs to keep its own employees and its own mission in business. And of course, there are many good people that want to do good for poor people in those countries, so it has an altruistic backing as well, but it's sadly unrealistic about what the effect of the aid will actually be. The foreign policy reason is that aid has often been not only about development, but also about the foreign policy goals of the US and the UK, for example. So one good reason why aid has gotten worse is that during the long war on terror and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the wars in Africa against terrorists, the World Bank has supported allies of the US government and allies of the UK government. So Uganda, for example, was providing troops to fight al-Shabaab in Somalia. And so the US policy, and of course the US chooses the president of the World Bank. So the US has plenty of leverage by which to control the policy of the World Bank. So they really want the World Bank to support US allies. And the World Bank, for its part, you know, it wants a lot of political backing for what it's doing. So it knows it can get political backing by cooperating with US foreign policy.
So is the takeaway here that the failure of supporting these autocrats is somehow embedded in the U.S. foreign policy State Department's objectives? Because I would have thought that the State Department would have been very opposed to supporting a number of African autocrats, maybe with the exception of these Ugandans. But what am I missing there?
Well, you're presuming that the U.S. State Department is opposed to human rights violations. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I guess so. You're saying that's not
Yeah.
true. It's
So,
generally not true. Well,
well, you know, I mean,
let me
it's
try a
funny
different line of
because
question because it sounds like that one answers itself.
okay.
You joined as a guest at one of my book clubs probably 10 to 15 years ago for the previous book that you wrote, which was also a condemnation of the World Bank. And I went around the room and asked each individual to decide would they cut to zero the amount of aid to the World Bank, cut it in half, or keep it the same. And when I came to you, you were very much misgivings on the question, and you said I guess I would keep the aid the same in the hope that the World Bank could be reformed. It's been 15 years since I asked you that question. When I ask you it again, what should we do about providing aid to the World Bank? Should we get rid? Should we cut it? Should we cut it in half, or should we keep it the same?
Well, I'm proud, actually, Larry, to be a reticent expert. I think there are too many experts that are overconfident on how they want to drastically change the world and are not cautious enough on how their ideas could cause harm instead of good. And I'm also cautious about that. I want to be a humble expert rather than an overconfident one. I do have to admit, in those 15 years, I have mostly given up on the hope of reforming the aid agencies or the World Bank. So I guess I have to admit I'm a lot more negative now than I was 15 years ago.
Okay. All right. With that, let's bring in Martin to the conversation. Martin, your last point related to the role of populists as not being leaders but followers of the angry public.
Right.
And given that, how do you expect the interaction between populace in the future to behave? Is it the populace found Trump, and should we expect the populace to find someone else who will represent them, or will someone, a leader, have to show up to engage the public? And how do we think about it in the context of the United States or France or the UK or any other country, for that matter, that's is a big one that we should be keeping our eyes open for?
Yeah, well, every country is, of course, different, but the phenomena is remarkably similar. And a lot of it has to do with what Bill was talking about. I mean, I was just sitting here shaking my head in wonder. It's not just the poor in Africa that get told by experts, this is the way you're supposed to be. I think that 20th century top-down model of democracy, which worked very well for many years because it had that semi-monopoly of information, had an almost mystical belief in expertise and a mystical belief that they own scientific truth. And that model, it was very comfortable, I think, to if you were part of that expert class, part of that ruling class, it must have been quite wonderful. You spoke and nobody talked back. I think to get at the populist question, we have to reform the options, the choices that the public gets. The public goes to a strange individual. I'm not going to pass political judgments. I don't think anybody, even a supporter of Donald Trump, would question this was a strange and bizarre individual who had no experience in any sort of politics or any sort of government service, only because the elites were not presenting the options that the public wanted. It was almost a statement of, okay, this guy is weird enough that he cannot possibly be one of them. I mean, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, for example, I mean, he makes Trump sound like an etiquette book. Okay, I mean, there is a sense that the public looks for these outrageous figures just to make sure he's not one of them, right? So what to do would be what Bill was saying. You have to listen to what the public is saying. Don't tell the public what they want. Listen to what the public is saying it wants. And if the moment you do this, you break through the logjam. And the moment the established parties, for example, can produce candidates that belong to that establishment and yet satisfy the options and the questions and the choices that the public wants, the less populism we will have.
Let's use some European countries as examples. Do you view Boris Johnson as a populist?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a really good question. I do. But come on, he's been in politics his whole life. He can orate in Greek, you know, in ancient Greek. This guy, he's one of a kind. So probably we should treat him that way. But yes, I do treat him as a populist because he took a stand with Brexit and when nobody else did in that political class. And Brexit was clearly the populist issue in the UK, in England, I would say.
And how would you view it in France? So when you look at the Macron election, there were four parties. Did you see a populist? Is the Le Pen example of a populist, or is that just a far-right example? How do you think about French politics?
Yeah, okay. So basically, when you look at that election, the one that Macron won, his party was in a sense the public's party. All right, he was a nobody. He follows the pattern of many. He made Boris Johnson look massively experienced by comparison. All right,
he had JP Morgan.
Right, he had been with Rothschild. He had been with a minister for a couple of years, and his party had just been created literally months before the first election. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't happen in France. Now, when he took over, he clearly took certain stands that were, in his mind, very centrist, but in the certain part of the public's mind, much more like the old stuff that they didn't want. I'd say populism in France, the obvious expression of it was those yellow vest demonstrations.
Before we get to the LOS, I want to get there for 1 second. So
yeah.
You're absolutely right. Imagine this is almost inconceivable in the United States that somehow a new party is created months before election, and not only does it win the presidency, but it also wins the Congress. I mean, just out of control, okay?
Right.
Just mind-boggling. But then when he comes to power, oh, my God, it's like he staffs it with all elites. He himself is viewed as an elite from the grade school. This is no Donald Trump. This is, you know, power is with the elites. It's an anti-populist party.
I have to say, you know, in France.
And then when the Yellow Jackets show up, it's like, who are these guys and how dare they?
Right. I mean, that's exactly right. And I became a very popular figure in France. The French, you know, I love France and I read French and badly speak it. But I mean, the French know their stuff. They feel like they are a very unique country, and they don't want anybody else to tell them what. They had no idea what was happening to them when the Yellow Vest struck. They started inviting me over. His party started inviting me over to talk to them to explain what was going on because they had no clue. When you look at those Yellow Vest protests, and you look at their YouTube, I mean, it's really kind of fascinating. I mean, they have these little songs where they go, if you're a rich hippie, you are a good guy, but if you are a plumber, you are a bad guy. I mean, it's the exact same thing that you see here in the United States with Trump. It's the idea that there's this class of rich, successful, globalized people who can work anywhere that are running the show and that don't even understand the language you're speaking, much less give a hoot about what it is that's important to you. And now they're having equal problems because they have mishandled the whole COVID situation pretty terribly.
Bill, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Last or 2 weeks ago, we had Charles Goodhart and Manoj Pradhan talk about their new book about Chinese demographics and how it will change the inflationary context of the world. And I asked the question about the future role of Africa and the future role of India to bring online these billions of people into the world economy. And they were very pessimistic. And I think they were pessimistic because they thought that what China was successful was because they had top-down planning. And then India, because it's democratic and chaotic, they would be unsuccessful at taking that next leap forward. And Africa would be a basket case because of the too many countries and a lack of property rights. How do you think about Chinese success as being a function of their top-down approach to problem solving? And in your framework, do you expect India to be successful or not?
Yeah, so I think one of the greatest myths in economic development discussions is this idea of the benevolent autocrat. And we're very much too quick to give credit for a dynamic economy to whichever autocrat happens to be presiding over it at the moment. The evidence when you check that idea doesn't support that. Oh, sorry, my dog just came in.
No problem.
My dog wants to participate in the discussion. And so, you know, what is going on with China? I mean, what is the most important thing that happened with China was the spread of economic freedom after Deng Xiaoping reluctantly let it open up in the late 1980s and continuing ever since then. Now partially reversed a little bit by Xi, but which of course coincided with the slowing down of growth. But the biggest story is simply that there was a massive expansion of economic freedom and the role of markets and the role of people choosing for themselves, and a massive increase in participation in the global economy and in international trade. And what was the result is very rapid growth from the previous extreme poverty under a Stalinist central planning model to a much greater level of prosperity under a market economy. That's the big story. And everything else kind of pales by comparison with that.
So maybe Martin, just to bring you in on the China top-down solution. Here you have a group of elites trying to control both the public information and how that's disseminated. It seems in your framework that sort of slow adaptation, centralized power is particularly at risk.
Well, I mean, I don't know what you mean by that. Explain a bit.
In other words, they have no ability to change the populace to control. They have no. They're desperately trying to both control information and prevent reforms. And all they can do is, you know, banish people off Facebook. But is that a loser? Can
totally.
They control information? Can they control dissent?
No, and no. And I think one of the truly fascinating things is watching our elite, some of them not that old, okay? Some of these are Gen X type leaders who essentially want to go back to the 20th century. They want nothing to do with the 21st. Within that group, I think to once again agree violently with what Bill said, there is this kind of sneaky admiration for what the Chinese are doing, right?
Sure.
I don't think this is necessarily people who want to overthrow the government and set up a similar system. I don't see how you could. That's the system is so one-off. But there is, you know, in little statements that are made about, well, the Chinese are better at this, the Chinese, you know, they've conquered COVID. Because Chinese COVID numbers, who the heck knows what they are, right? I mean, this is a country that essentially cooks the numbers on everything it does. So, but there is, to our own elites, this admiration of they think that they themselves, the Chinese, don't have this fear of the public and can just kind of point the gun and say, do it. But the reality is, when you look what's happening in Hong Kong, is that even in China, there's trouble with controlling the public when the public really wants to make a statement on the streets. I think what's kept them going is they have been tremendously successful economically. I have talked to many, many Chinese who hated the system but told me things like, well, my grandfather lived with pigs in a hut, mm-hmm. and I'm going to Harvard, you know, so why should I want to rock the boat? But all it takes is for that economy to take a bad tumble, and wait and see.
And, Martin, do you have any predictions as to what your framework means for both the elites and governments? Does it mean that we're going to see, you started with this, you know, how fragile the Arab world was in terms of the Arab Spring and how they fell down. Do you see similar concerns among governments in Europe or other important allies of ours? Who is more at risk, the more open societies, the more closed ones? How do you think about that? Or do you think it's going to be more of the same and that elites will just adapt to this revolt of the public?
Once again, I will cite my new hero, Bill Easterly, and say, no, of course the open societies are much more flexible and much more adaptable than authoritarian governments. I don't do predictions. Again, citing the same person, is we need to be humble about predictions. You want to be wrong, make a forecast, okay? However,
it's hard to be an expert in this world to be when you're being humble, Martin. It's not easy. Demand for humble experts is very small, actually.
Too true. But I mean, I think the most important question that nobody seems to be asking right now is, okay, as I said, in 2019 we had this, I mean, that wave, that cycle of protests that began in 2011 was cresting, just cresting. It was incredible to watch, right? It was everywhere in the world, and it was pretty powerful. And then we put this lid of a quarantine that is the most, as somebody said, you know, the greatest and most thorough global quarantine in the history of the human race. And in about no more than a year plus, that lid is going to blow. It's probably blowing already, for all we know, right? And what's the public going to want when it comes out? And I have no answer. I mean, I think one possible possibility is that it's going to be you know, it's got to come out with all the repressed anger and frustration and rage and think you people really messed up this COVID thing, and you're going to get revolt on steroids. Equally possible, honestly, the way I'm feeling right now, which is, you know, just give me my vaccine and I'm off to have fun, right? You get the roaring 2020s or something like that. I don't know, but nobody seems to be asking this question. It is probably the most important one in politics today.
So we had Chris Arnotti speak on the call in March, and he said, oh my God, if we quarantine three generations of a family in a small living space, there's people can get hurt, and there's going to be an explosion. We're getting a powder keg. And then we had, you know, the Black Lives Movement going on, and there was a lot of demonstrations nationally and globally, for that matter, on a variety of topics. Why do you think we heated up and then cooled back down?
Those things are very random. There's no specific. I mean, there are issues that lie dormant for years, and you can see that there are people trying to make a case out of them, and nobody's paying attention. And suddenly one thing happens, and for many, many, it's like viral messages. You know, you can make all kinds of rules about what makes a viral message, and I actually studied that, and I studied in CIA and afterwards. But then you can take those same damn rules and you apply them to probably a million other messages that didn't go viral. So I can't begin to tell you why that happened. All I can tell you is that the potential for that is simmering at a very high level of intensity underneath that lid that's been placed in COVID. Whether it's going to explode politically, whether it's going to explode in party mode, and I would just want to get to work and make up all the money that I lost while all this happened. Who knows? Who knows? But we should be thinking about it.
I think your point is, like, who knew when the Arab Spring started that it would be that fruit merchant in Tunis that would kickstart this whole thing?
Totally, totally true. I mean, that's a perfect example.
I wonder if I could ask
someone
want to
say something? Go ahead, David. Is that you? Go ahead.
Yes, yes. I wondered what our two speakers would make of this. Bill's argument is essentially that the free market and people operating kind of within it will come up with good information about development. But in the case of the lots of new media and a free market in the media in many parts of the world, it seems to be throwing up very bad information. That's to say, it seems a massive generator of fake news. I mean, is the answer that there's something missing in Bill's theory, or is it that in the United States and in Western Europe and many other parts of the world, we don't in fact have a free media, and it's quite wrong to see what we see on the internet as the product of the grassroots, and it's rather the product of very particular interests who can control in many, many ways the kind of things that it appears. In other words, is it partly the strength of the old media kind of reproduced through new media, or is it new kinds of control of information using the new media?
Well,
in other words, is populism not the right way to understand what's been going on? That's to say that we have kind of elite forces mobilizing particular segments of the population using old and new media.
Can I answer that?
Do you want to take that vote?
Yeah. That is a very comforting theory that the elites tell themselves, which is behind all this craziness, all these crazy people, there is an elite figure that's manipulating it all. That's very comforting to the elites. I have seen no evidence of that, honestly. I mean, in cases like Donald Trump's, obviously he's out there stirring the pot. But most, including the people that support him, most of the movements that I've seen, both with street protests and with the election of populists, these are bottom-up eruptions. And they have to do with precisely breaking the mold that the elites want to maintain very, very intact. But yeah, I mean, I hear this again and again, and I have people that, I mean, and there's a lot of data on this, by the way. I mean, it's a lot of data that, for example, the fake news in 2016 had, was there any? Oh, yeah, lots. Did the Russians meddle? I mean, I'm CIA. Of course they meddle. They always do. Did it change a single mind? I have seen no evidence of that, okay? I have seen no evidence of that. So the fact that things, and I would dispute the premise, which is that information is bad. There's a lot of information out there. What's missing is not good or bad. There's lots of good information out there. What's missing is authority. What's missing is a person that we jointly turn to, and when that person says, or an institution, obviously, says, okay, this is reality. This is the way we see truth right now. We all say, okay, well, that source has spoken. Now we have agreed. That's what authority is. Truth is not some platonic form. It's not a gift from science. It's basically something we receive from an authority. And when the authorities have exploded, truth is up for grabs.
So, let me agree with my new friend, Martin. So, you know, if you're worried about the problem of fake news has always been around and has always been horrible, most horribly, horrifically severe in authoritarian societies. You know, if you want to look at places where hatreds and conspiracy theories are rife, you know, just look at any authoritarian society where journalists are in the pay of authoritarian elite actors. So more freedom is the answer to better information. It's not the problem, it's the answer to better information. Let me also say something I think Martin will agree with, that I think
you're disagreeing with each other. You're not agreeing.
We are disagreeing. Okay, whatever. I think elites actually make the problem worse by telling the public, here's what you should think. You know, and we've gone from, you know, persuasion, which was the basis of freedom of speech, to kind of dictation. You know, this is what you should think. And that's what causes elites to lose trust in the mainstream media sources, I think.
If I could add one last thing. We spoke about France and the yellow vests. The leader of the ruling party there on March, Macron's party, was asked, what's going on? And he said, I think our policies are too intelligent and too subtle for the public to understand. That tells you everything you need to know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.